Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. Hope you are also.
Yep. You know, just a wonderful week going on here in Colorado. We're having some trouble up in Wyoming. I don't know if that's made the national news. We've got the big fire going on up in Larimer County in Wyoming. It's a kind of out of control wildfire, but the smoke's not made it down this way, and hopefully they'll have that situation under control soon. Anything interesting going on in your world these days?
Not a whole lot. I did see Prometheus. I think I mentioned that before the show got kicked off, and I do recommend it, and perhaps we'll let more of our audience watch it before we get into any kind of in-depth conversation on it.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, wait until a few more people have tuned in for sure, and then just tell us how it ends, right?
Yeah. I think we'd get a bad reputation if I was to spoil that movie, so I'm going to just say I thought it was great, you know, two thumbs up, go see it.
Recommendations on Prometheus. Okay, well, I'm planning on seeing it this weekend, so we can, assuming I manage to make that happen next week, we'll talk about it cryptically here on the program. That'll be fun for everyone, I'm sure, if we do that. So we'll make that the plan. Well, we got a huge show tonight, so we're gonna jump right in, and I'm going to bring out our guest. We're very pleased to welcome Aisha Khanna to Fast Forward Radio. She is the founder and director of the Hybrid Reality Institute, a research and advisory group focused on human technology coevolution and geotechnology. She's a partner at K2S Advisors, which provides strategic and financial advisory services in smart and sustainable cities, technology, and infrastructure. She's also a faculty advisor at Singularity University and directs the Future Cities Group at the London School of Economics. Her new book is called Hybrid Reality. It's out as of yesterday from TED Books. Aisha, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Hello. It's great to be on Fast Forward Radio. Hello, Phil. Hello, Stephen.
Great, we're very pleased
to have you with us, and congrats on the book being published. I should mention that you are the co-author of that, along with your husband, Parag. And very, very interesting dynamic there. We've got the husband and wife team futurists, kind of evocative of the Toffler's writing Future Shock, and I believe that's even referenced in the book.
Yes, the Toffler's have been a huge inspiration for us. We actually had a couple of double dates with them in Los Angeles over the last years, and we've been reading them for many, many years, and we found them to be extremely insightful. Even today, many of the things that they've written are still very relevant.
That's really cool. So I don't think that is mentioned in the book that you've actually been in touch with them, and in effect, the torch is being passed here to the new generation of Tofflers, if you will.
We would be honored if they considered that, but we're just very grateful that they read the book, they really liked it. And I think we've just learned an enormous deal. And I would encourage everyone to reread several of their books, including Future Shock, which is very well known.
Yes, those are terrific books. What was the other one? The Third Wave, I think, was the other really big one. That
yeah.
Yeah, that they wrote. Okay, well, terrific. We want to jump in and talk about the book. I was really pleased to get my virtual hands on it yesterday, and I was able to read through it between yesterday morning and showtime tonight, which was my goal. And I think we've got an awful lot to talk about. I want to start just by let's define our terms a little bit and talk about what the hybrid age is. The book starts out talking about the hybrid age. There's one passage in there where you say it's the period between the information age and the technological singularity. And then I thought it was very interesting that near the end of the book, you say that the question of whether we get it right in the hybrid age is actually more important than the question of what happens after the singularity. So what exactly is this critical era that we're currently experiencing? What is the hybrid age all about?
Well, the hybrid age is at the frontier of the information age, which we have all been in and have been experiencing for several decades now. And it is the point at which technology is once again morphing, and through two ways. First of all, different spheres and different disciplines that include technology are each other. So one example, for instance, is biology, mechanical engineering, and electronics, for instance, are merging to form a new field called biomechatronics. And so what biomechatronics does that neither of the three fields, its component fields, could do very well individually is create very sophisticated prosthetics that are, in fact, done at several universities, including Hugh Hare's department. He started that at MIT. These are the kind of prosthetics that could be put on disabled and, in fact, able-bodied people, make them superhuman in some ways. So this is an example of disciplines moving forward at high speed and, in fact, merging together to form new disciplines and new types of disruptive technologies that are completely unexpected. That's one aspect of the hybrid age. The other fundamental pillar of it is that now humans are going to be merging with technologies themselves. And this, of course, comes in several ways. Healthcare is the most obvious one, in which we have not only new kinds of off-the-shelf organs, but also neural and cognitive enhancers that will really make us an enhanced super species. And what we try to discuss in this book is that this hybrid age, this period as these new technologies emerge in our lifestyle and come to the forefront, this period is very important because this is what will define how we will approach the singularity. And the singularity is just that moment in time when machine intelligence becomes greater than human intelligence. And it is completely unknown what will happen after that time. But surely the answer must lie in how we design and how we embed some of our own values as a species into our approach to our technology design that gets us to that point. And maybe the answer is that we become machine integrated, or that we've designed them in a certain way that have certain protection against machines overruling us as a species. But we feel that these several decades, and it could be as much as a century before we reach the singularity, are extremely important because they have to be navigated in a thoughtful manner. And a lot of the hype in the media about the singularity, unfortunately, while it's very good to make people cognizant of its importance, also kind of makes them unaware of all the many steps that you need to take to get from here to there.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting that you lay it out in those kinds of terms. It's familiar ground for us on this program. We talk about the singularity pretty regularly, and it seems there are myriad ways it can pan out, but it comes down to a few core options for how things might go down, as you were saying. Either the singularity is something that occurs that's completely out of our control and leads us to bad, and when I say bad, we're talking really bad outcomes, or it's something that occurs that is under our control, or as Stephen likes to say, the greater than human intelligence emerges and it's us, so it's not in any way actually a threat to us because we're it and it's continuous with us, or ideally it's some friendly entity that has our best interest at heart. So actually, when you say that the question of how we deal with the hybrid age is more important, it's ultimately because what we do now is going to determine, we hope, what those outcomes will be. It's going to determine how the singularity occurs and whether it produces a beneficial results or whether it takes us in the wrong direction. Is that fair to say?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly very well said, and that's exactly what we mean.
Cool. I love the quote that you have William Gibson in the book, where he said, you know, I don't really have to write about the future anymore. He's a science fiction author. He can write about the present. It's shocking enough. What is something that's happening right now that would, you know, that you found shocking as you were researching for this book regarding how humanity and technology are evolving together?
Well, I mean, for me, one of the areas that is very interesting, and people talk a lot about, technology is being primarily the internet, and they tend to associate it a lot with social media. So for many of us, it seems that the speed of technological change is the speed of new apps that comes to iTunes. But in fact, I think we need to step back and really think even about biotech, nanotech, clean tech, or even just about this new phenomenon of smart cities, which means how our very public environment, how the built environment is now actually overlaid with soft infrastructure. And we're going to begin to see many of these ever cheaper sensors being embedded in the buildings in which we live, on the floors we walk, even in our own bodies. And we're beginning to see some instances of these in new greenfield cities that are being built from scratch in places like Korea, attempted in places like Portugal, and in living labs in Europe. And I think that is going to be very, very interesting because they are becoming smaller and smaller. And so these technologies are going to become invisible, yet they will have the ability to watch us, to exchange information and intelligently respond to us. And the question then becomes, from a social implication point of view, well, then who are the companies or the government organizations that really own this data or technologies? And so part of what we do in the book is, you know, think about the technology, but then also start to think about, okay, let's really think from a social systems perspective. What does that mean for how we live our lives, or what does that mean for the social contract that we have as a society together with our government, and what are the expectations we should have of large companies that have massive amounts of data on us? And Facebook and our credit card companies are just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to technology autonomously gathering data about us.
Yeah. Some pretty scary implications there, aren't there?
Yes, they are. But I think, as we point out in the book, that, you know, technology, as we all know, people who are technologists, it's just a double-edged sword. So I really think that in itself, technology is value neutral. And it has both, it can be used in both good and evil ways. And it is, by human beings, used as such. So I think, as important as it is to be aware of the negative consequences, always also very important to be hopeful and optimistic about the great breakthroughs in healthcare, longevity, and in fact also in bringing the developing world out of poverty that it can bring. But I think that having this balanced approach, veering neither towards techno-utopianism nor towards techno-pessimism, right way to go forward.
Yeah, for sure. I actually had a piece on my other blog on Transparency Revolution today. It was a link I had followed off /dot about how the Tor undernet, which, you know, is based on this technology that was developed in part by the U.S. government. I think it started with U.S. Navy research to enable anonymity, to stop tracking, to stop to curb pushy governments, from being able to control what people are doing online. And that technology has now swung around and it's become something that's used by child pornographers, it's used by drug traffickers, and it's very hard now for the authorities to track these people down because they're using, you know, technology that was intended to stop the bad guys from blocking access to the internet. So it's one of these it's interesting that domain is Onion, I think, onion.net, onion.org, something like that, because it's a many layered issue, isn't it? We seem to think, well, we're creating technology to serve good ends, and the first thing you know, it's doing almost the opposite of what we wanted it to do.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. And I think that goes to, a framing or a way of understanding how technology works. And we use the framing of generativity. And generativity is a concept that has been used by, Noam Chomsky. It's been used by Pierre Bourdieu, who's a sociologist. And it talks about how there are certain structures that lend themselves to being inclusive and participatory. And most recently, Jonathan Zittrain from Harvard Law School really pointed out how the internet is generative. So it allows a large and heterogeneous group of users to come together and create and extend it in unexpected ways. But this means it's been designed in a way that's very open. And we see that in education. We see that in even government, where new parastatal organizations are now forming an ecosystem of semi-governmental players. And we see that in healthcare as all of us participate and perhaps even begin to experiment on our... but the idea is that its very openness is the best thing about it, but it's also its most dangerous thing, because what is open to somebody very smart so that we can collectively solve big problems is also open to cyber thieves, is also open to pornographers, is also open to dictators. And it's very difficult to stop them. So really, generativity, they say, lies at the edge of chaos and control. And you really need to constantly find that balance. And it's unfortunate our governments are really not very good at it, because obviously they're always a little behind the curve, as we've seen with something like the financial crisis. And some of the technologies we're talking about here are far more complicated and move at far greater speed than the models that were incorrect and led to the mortgage crisis. So I think that a big part of our book is a wake-up call to us as citizens to both create situations in which we come together in a kind of activism to not only demand access to technology, but also to insist on transparency and certain regulations or certain rules or certain watch in which we could protect ourselves from misuse.
Right. Well, now, generative systems and structures, one of the important concepts, really, really interesting concept that's laid out in the book, I want to swing it back and talk about two other terms that you introduced in the book. One is geotechnology, and the other one, am I pronouncing this correctly, is it Technik or Technique? A guy named Bauermaster should be able to pronounce a German word, but I'm not sure.
It's Technik.
Technik, okay. So now, if I read you correctly, geotechnology is this distribution among the global powers of dominance in the various key technological sectors, basically who leads in which technologies, whereas Technik is going to speak to the society's overall approach to technology, like how adaptable it is to technology, how successfully it's co-evolving with technology. So my first question is, why is it necessary to distinguish between these two things? Wouldn't the nation that is the most friendly with and adaptable to a particular technology naturally become the leader in that space?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think, first of all, geotechnology is kind of an approach to understanding balance of power on the global scale. And so if you compare countries and if you compare nation states in the last kind of centuries, people have really focused on geopolitics and geoeconomics. And the argument over there is that really what moves history forward and what creates the discrepancies in who wins and who loses in on the global economic and political scale is really technologies. And in fact, there's a great emphasis now on state sponsorship of certain kind of technologies, which we're seeing in China, which has just devoted about $1 trillion to investing in leading leading sectors like nanotech, biotech, clean tech. And this will give them a lot of power. So it's very important if you're trying to understand who are going to be the leading societies, cities of the future in terms of economic and political power, to think from a geotechnological framework. Now, technic, on the other hand, is how well a society is adapting to it, which doesn't necessarily mean it is the most powerful state in the world. I mean, Finland and Singapore are countries, and the Scandinavian countries are countries that are making great effort to adapt to technology in a way that is healthy for their societies in some ways. And good technic is how well you are prepared for new technology disruptions, by how well you've integrated it into a culture, into something that is culturally suitable to you and to whatever stage in the trajectory of development you are at. So India may have a different technic than Japan, which may have a different technic than the U.S. So whatever best for society, and think that that is the distinction over here. And technic can actually happen at the individual level as well. So companies can have good technic. Individuals can have good technic. So you may be in a country that is not very well prepared for the hybrid age, but in fact, you may be already educating yourself personally by using certain tools and mentors. You may already be preparing for a world in which automation may displace your current job. The state system or even corporations are not providing the infrastructure to enable you to do that as a whole. So technic is really what people should aspire to and what state, nations and societies should aspire to. But geotechnology is more, I think, about power and clout in the world.
So if you look at the relationship between the two, is it fair to say that that technic helps to maybe smooth out the balance of power a little bit? It provides some capability and some clout to, as you said, some of these countries that you wouldn't necessarily have thought of as big players on the global stage, but their acumen with technology is actually providing them a place that they wouldn't have had before.
Yes, and it's providing them a house. So I think that's really the key. And obviously what happens that if they at the simultaneously they invest in the government is simultaneously investing in some of the leading sectors, it could give them enormous economic power. So, you know, anywhere from nanotechnology breakthrough to manufacturing to coming up with new longevity enhanced drugs, it really depends on how they're using it. They may use it, for instance, a small country that uses it to subsidize its population and make it very smart and able to work many longer hours or be far more than a much larger country will have great advantages over it. So it does translate into prosperity, economic prosperity in the long run as well, or it can.
Right.
Hi, Aisha. I recently wrote about an idea I'm calling the coffee shop future, where, you know, people, you know, telecommuters, you know, sometimes they're meeting at coffee shops, or people that are becoming educated, you know, online, in places like coffee shops or at home or whatever. They're outside of the normal locations for doing things, in large part because of these tools. And in my article, I was a lot of time talking about these things, really with the idea of we're going to do it because we can. But as I was reading your book, I realized that, you know, we're going to do it because we have to. You know, we're not going to have time as a society for everybody to go get a 4-year degree every time a new paradigm hits. It seems like we're going to have to be we're going to have to be a lot more flexible, a lot more mobile and quick to get up to speed on things as we go into the future. I think your ideas of generative education are a big part of that.
Yes. Yeah, that's very true. I think on both counts, first, about the necessity to change and to be agile and flexible. And I think there are going to be two reasons for this. One is clearly that, you know, new opportunities are going to come from technology disruption that are for the foresightful are going to really enable them to capitalize and move up the social ladder. So 3D manufacturing, for instance, presents a huge opportunity for small producers and mom and pop shops to really be able to design new products and create new products and set up shops. But I mean, those will have to kind of be looking at this right now. And I would really urge people not to be intimidated by these technologies, because if you remember the internet, the first days of the web, you know, very few people would actually code in HTML. And they were the only people who could put up their web pages. And now we have people who are blogging and tweeting and on Facebook and constantly publishing without knowing a single word of how to code. And we will very, very soon, actually far sooner than transition from publishing tools, from HTML to publishing tools happen, see these kind of easy user-friendly tools that will enable people to design objects and print them. So I think that one should move quickly into understanding how these things can be done. The other thing is what happens when these new technologies come is that they disrupt what you already think of as a profession. So we already know that there is now software that can analyze legal documents far faster and cheaply than paralegals or even lawyers can do. So if that really happens at a large scale, that entire profession, except for very few people who are going to be dealing with the intricacies of unexpected situations and legal cases, will be out of a job. So automation is a big threat, and automation in this case, unlike before, previously, is not going to, the introduction of technology is not going to increase productivity for humans to move up the value chain. It will just displace the human being altogether. So what this does is it calls into question an education system that prepares us for jobs that are not going to be as profitable or as many as they were before available to students. So one has to, what really needs an education system or an ecosystem of mentors, of education modules, of vocational training that you pick and choose as your and consider a life of a long career, so becoming a lifelong student, and use many resources that enable you to adapt to structural changes in labor markets. And a generative system is precisely that. It means that you can you have a system that is not just about certain institutional players that are associated with, so Harvard, Yale, Stanford, or even very well-known high schools. I think it's going to be much more about, you know what, I took this class with this guy on Udacity, it was free, and I took this course on Coursera, and this, I worked for this guy, and he gave me a great a recommendation on LinkedIn, and in fact, if you look at my clout score, you can see that a lot of people consider me very influential and a thought leader in this, and together there's going to be some algorithm that enables future employers and future clients to kind of be able to judge how good you are at something. Actually, I think much more, if we do it right, that's a much more democratic and better system than what we have right now.
Well, certainly it's a more adaptable system and one that is more in line with the reality of how people how people's careers unwind or how they unfold as you were saying, the assumption that you would reach a certain point in your late adolescence where you're going to get your quote unquote education, right? and then you'll start your career. And since you had your education, you're all set to do whatever you want to do. You know, even today seems fairly antiquated. Seems seems like a pretty old-fashioned idea. But you know, what we're seeing happening now is the very real possibility that that we never stop being educated, right? That becomes incorporated into everything we do, and the line, very bright lines that we've had between, well, right now I'm in school, right now I'm working on my career, now I'm going back to school for a while, now I'm back into my career, that all sort of fades away, doesn't it? Where maybe we're more doing both at the same time continually throughout our entire working lives.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And remember, we are doing this, and this is where, you know, the generativity of the system comes in, and so are billions of people from the developing world who are also going to be our competitors, but potentially collaborators as well. So we really don't have a choice.
But, right.
I'm currently taking a course on Coursera on called Introduction to Sociology, because I'm doing some writing, and I needed just some basic information. They like the professor. It's free. It's online. And, you know, there are actually live seminars that he has in Princeton that you can participate in, some of them. It's wonderful. Why wouldn't you do that? It's just something that I needed at the moment, and I don't have to, you know, go back and pay $30,000-$40,000 a year to resource. And imagine, for instance, Sebastian, who started Audacity and teaches artificial intelligence, was responsible for the Google driverless car. His first course on Audacity was how to create a robotic car. And can you imagine that only the very students in the world could have access to that professor teaching that class? And now anybody in a small town in India or Africa or Brazil can log on to the internet and get that information. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, and I think that these very people then, like I said, are both our competitors and also our collaborators in the future. It's really how we play the game today.
Absolutely. Well, it's a great leveler, levels the playing field, and also creates huge opportunities. Actually, I have to tell you, we have a tradition on Fast Forward Radio of every week we have a technical glitch. And Stephen and I were talking about this before we were talking to you earlier this evening, and we had a really bad one last week. I think we've got a slightly minor one this week, which is that we seem to be dropping your audio somewhat, and I wonder if it would be possible if you could just hang up and call right back in. I think we might get a stronger signal, and we might be able to hear you a little bit better if you wouldn't mind doing that.
Oh, yes. Okay. I'll call right back. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.
Thank you. Okay. Well, hopefully it'll sound better when we get her back in here.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't so bad that I can't follow her, but I saw some comments in the chat room. I'm not sure if it sounds better to us maybe than it does to the folks listening, so we just want to make sure that everyone can hear Aisha, because she's got so many great things to say.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll wait for her to dial back in.
Well, tell me about the fires, Phil. It's in Wyoming, you were saying?
Yeah, Larimer County, southern part of Wyoming. Actually, it's interesting. You know, we've got this beetle blight in some of the mountain areas, and they're actually allowing some of the fire to burn just because it's clearing out places where the trees have been damaged already. But it's also hitting residential areas, and it's been quite destructive. People have lost livestock. I believe a couple of people have lost their lives, and hundreds of homes now have been destroyed. It's a very sad situation, actually.
Oh, okay. I had heard a little something about it on NPR the other day, and I think we have our caller back.
Okay.
Our guest is back.
Hi, guys. I hope this is better.
Yeah, it does. Thank you. Sorry to put you through that. One thing we point out is that we've been doing Blog Talk Radio for, what, Stephen, 5 years now? Is that right? Almost 5 years?
A long time, yeah.
And they said they were in beta when we first started. They still say they're in beta. So
It's like the Gmail beta. You know, is Gmail still in beta?
I think it might be. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah. It's just you know, it's the convenient thing to blame when something like this occurs. We appreciate your flexibility on this, and let's jump back in. I want to talk a little bit about some paradigm shifts that are explored at some length in the book. One is the transition from medical treatment to medical enhancement. I thought that idea was really interesting. And you also talk about the diffusion of authority from the state to really just a whole host of players. And then there's this idea of the evolution of the individual into a brand. Now, I see these three trends as being kind of oddly connected to each other, but my question would be, of those three, which would you be inclined to tell our listeners is the one that will have the greatest impact on their lives as individuals over the next few years, and why would you say that's the case?
Well, I think that what would really have an influence, and this has already been talked about, is in the immediate short term will be really considering yourself as a brand. Because we are already, the middle class already, experiencing stagnation in the West and in Western Europe, obviously, as well. And I think that it's really important for people to now consider themselves, and more people in the U.S. are beginning to become self-employed and are really beginning to think of ways to promote themselves as entrepreneurs and not as part of any institution, so as freelancers. And I think it's important to see for them how they can continue to educate themselves and how they can continue to build their brand and how they can really use some of the technologies that are there to prepare for an age in which there may be several disruptions and there may be several new opportunities, such as the 3D manufacturing that I was talking about earlier. But it's a short jump from there, I think, to the other one, the first one, in which we talk the transition from medical treatment as prevention or as therapy to becoming enhancement. Because, again, it's a huge disruption that's very related to labor markets. As people begin to, right now, ironically, we depend on people who are very, very sick, who are actually at the edge of, between life and death, to take on the experiments that are going to be part of these future enhancements. So, for instance, experiment, usually people who are paralyzed or who've suffered from serious accidents are willing to have chips implanted in their brains to allow them to communicate directly with computers.
Right.
We're still at early stages of this, but these kind of brain-computer interfaces, as they develop, those people who can afford it and those people who have these implants will actually have great advantage over others in the labor market. I mean, there's no way I can compete with somebody who is literally connected to a supercomputer, which Google is, or which even Facebook is, because there are so many servers in parallel crunching huge amounts of information at any given time. So I think they're all very intimately connected, as you said, as is the third one, which is, how are we governed and how do we govern ourselves as society and what are the players that eventually determine the economic atmosphere and the political atmosphere in which we are able to live our lives and become productive beings. And again, this system of governance is quite generative and also determines what options there are to us. People in China, for instance, have certain options that they will have available, and we've already seen this. It's quite stifled in many respects, whereas in the U.S., we have an advantage right now that a number of these parastatal organizations are coming up that together, but through public-private partnerships, have the potential to create an environment in which we can create new kinds of, can create cutting-edge technologies and really become the leading exporters and the most prosperous in the world.
One of the things that that got my attention, staying on that point for a moment, around how we're governed, was the idea that if we don't have structures in place that are generative, that are adaptive, and that that possess a certain amount of this technique you're talking about, we end up with a situation where capabilities will exist and people will get them, and it will all happen outside of the system. That essentially you'll have a gray market or a black market that will be supporting people going after getting capabilities that they need, or getting enhancements that they need, or you know, taking care of their lives in ways that they feel would be beneficial to them, and the system starts to sort of crumble, doesn't it? Because it's not supporting where people actually need to go. And what do you think happens in that scenario? I was interested in reading that, and I tried to extrapolate where that leads next. I know in the book you talk about there being kind of a class of technological haves versus have-nots, but does some equilibrium set in? Would that situation force the government to become more responsive, more technologically savvy, or would chaos ensue, do you think?
Well, you know, I think that the best way to look at this is actually to look at countries, and there exist several countries already in the world where the black market is a significant part of the economy. If you just look at Pakistan, over 50% of economic productivity actually occurs in the black market. It's never documented. The state is not involved in any respect. It is not regulating it. And, you know, as a result of that, the people are completely apathetic to the state, and they are really creating, there's a lot of increasing gap between the people who are benefiting from black market and from access to certain resources and the high rents that they are forcing upon people who don't have it. And this leads to all kinds of issues in which, as you've seen, because of people are so unhappy, and it comes to a point where really the government, I think it is almost impossible for it to take control back of the situation, to take back control of the situation, and we really don't want to enter into that era. And right now, you know, in the example of Pakistan, for instance, you know, these are not like dangerous technologies.
Right.
They are literally, people are trying to get a power line to have a light on at night,
sure.
And they don't get it from the state utility, but they get it from some slumlord, for instance. But imagine the slumlord had access to pills, or the slumlord was able to really determine, how some of these enhancements or even life-saving drugs that are not available through the normal channels in which we see them in the West, what would happen to a country like that, and what it would do if there are certain extremist groups or terrorist groups that are able to have access to those resources. I do think that one ends up in a situation that's very chaotic, that it is actually worse than, you know, just a world in which some people live in the slums and are very poor, and then there are pockets of these very rich people. I mean, if you see that movie Time, which I thought was very interesting, actually. Was it Time, the one with just Justin Timberlake?
Oh, yeah. What was the name of that? We've talked about that movie.
Yeah, we talked recently about it, where they can buy additional time or earn additional time.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, they died at a very young age otherwise. I forget the name of it. Interesting concept.
It was interesting, but the whole idea was, you know, that people can live, the very poor people live in these slums, and then very far away there are these very rich people in enclaves. But we've already seen that in many countries, from Venezuela to, to Sao Paulo. But the thing is, the crime rate really goes up. Nobody
right.
is completely protected, but then nobody's borders are, completely walled off. And especially in Europe, where, you know, unless you have robots come in, you need immigrants. And you need to be able to have an equitable way of sharing resources and sharing new technologies. And my background is actually in human rights. And so I really feel that access to these technologies is a human right. And what people do with it then really determines the technique, the individual technique, and their ability to adapt to it determines how well they do. But to keep it from them it will lead to all kinds of problems. I think the black market just being the tip of the iceberg. We'll see chaos. We'll see terrorism. We'll see a lot of crime.
Mm. Wow. Sobering thought.
Absolutely. Aisha, there's much in the book about cities. Looking forward, does our technology pull us together into smart cities, or does it push us apart into a giant suburbia where every place can be a virtual city if we choose it to be? Which do you see going forward?
Well, I see the opposite. I think that, you know, the trend is that across the world, even in developed countries, that more and more people are actually moving to the cities. So by 2050, you know, over 70% of the human population will be living in urban areas. And that basically gives us a lot of advantages, because we're, as we know, because of the density of cities, actually, and because people live in buildings and commute by car less, cities are ironically more sustainable, but also they're more innovative, because people are able to collaborate much more easily. But that is very hard for cities to do when there's such an onslaught of immigrants or migrants to the city, especially in countries like China and India and Brazil, where the middle class is really aspirations to live like the Western middle class. And the infrastructure in these countries is very poor. So what we're really seeing is across the board, whether it is in the Western developed world or the developing world, there is a great push to modernize cities. And this time people understand that that doesn't mean just building new buildings, but as I was mentioning earlier, that means embedding technology in these buildings so that you can provide better healthcare, better education, and be but more sustainable and green. And I think we will see this both in cities that are being built from scratch. So in China itself, you know, you expect upwards of 50 cities or some claim there, over 200 cities that will be built over the coming decades. And there will be a lot of retrofits of cities, as we're seeing in Europe and even in the U.S. There's a new site in New Mexico that was recently made the news, in which a new city is being built, in which a number of these new technologies of sensors, where let's say your grandparent falls down and the hospital is alerted, and the hospital has all the information on your grandparent, and in fact it has a pill that if your grandparent has Alzheimer's and may forget to take that, if he does take it, will automatically email the doctor. You know, the irony is this all seems to us, well, don't we already have this because we've seen so many movies, but we actually don't. And we will begin to see this integration of software systems in cities, especially in cities as they become smarter. And the quality of life and the quality of services should improve dramatically when we see that. Of course, it's very important to realize that whenever this happens, this means somebody who's providing you the service and somebody who's taking your personal data. And what they're doing with this data, or how they are in turn then making you pay for these services, is a big question. Is it a government entity? Is it a corporation? Is it an insurance company? Do you really want them to know what you're doing at all times? And I think that, most of us, especially parents, will probably agree to it just because of the security advantages that it offers.
Right, a seeming double-edged sword, as we mentioned before. Well, we've got just a few minutes left, and I want to get to some of the bigger philosophical issues that come up towards the end of the book. In the later chapters, there's two closely related ideas that get explored. One is how our lives are becoming intertwined with technology to the extent that our identities themselves are being redefined, and then there's a chapter on how to avoid the robo-apocalypse. And you touch on a very disturbing story that I had not heard about a Korean couple who actually allowed their baby daughter to starve to death while they were addicted to an online game in which they were essentially raising a virtual child, which is just an astounding, shocking story. But my question would be, which do you think is the greater potential danger, that our technology will literally go to war with us and try to destroy us, or that it might allow us to destroy ourselves by enabling our own kind of de-evolution into something that we never wanted to become and never should have become?
I think it's probably the latter, honestly, because I think that right now machines are definitely not that intelligent that they have an autonomous, and they're not autonomous entities that can actually rage against us. In fact, that is the whole fear of the post-singularity phase, and we're very far from that. But what these technologies can do is to highlight, to enable certain extremes that we have within ourselves, whether as designers of technologies or as consumers of technologies. And that is essentially what we saw with the Korean couple. They were not using some very futuristic, immersive virtual reality technology. They were really just playing a game but they were just addicted to it because there are certain addictive elements in all video games. And they're, in fact, designed to be addictive. And for those of us who may be vulnerable to that or excited by that, we really have to be very careful. This was a horrifying story, but another one that we point out is also, people begin to take their virtual lives so seriously that there are people who have affairs in Second Life, or it doesn't even need to be Second Life. We'll see many other kind of massive virtual worlds emerge, and then they might get so jealous that they might come and kill you in real life. So it's very blurry, the distinction between what is real and what is not real. And this is not to say that what is virtual is not real, but between what is virtual and physical, I think. And part of what we say is that this line becomes blurry because, frankly, it should become blurry. They're both reality. Mm-hmm. But reality is very closely tied to our sense of self. And I think that moving beyond it, altering realities, there are several ways in which our what we consider reality is altered. One is, what do we see? So with augmented reality, we can see a lot more. But we can also delete reality by the same notion. So I can walk around and there are certain things that I don't like in my environment. Maybe there are homeless people that I don't like to see. Or maybe I'm a homophobe and I don't like to see gay couples. This is very disturbing. Or maybe I want to identify gay couples because I'm a racist and I want to identify people from a certain country. This just, again, points to the fact that it can bring out extreme parts of our personality that we just didn't have the avenue to explore or vent earlier. That's one thing about reality. The other is our sense of reality is very much about the relationships that we have and how those, our sense of self is reflected in the eyes of people that we interact with all the time. And if these players or actors that we interact with are not just human beings but are technologies, then again, our sense of self is a bit destabilized because those technologies, those avatars that are social are pre-programmed in certain ways. And they may be able to manipulate us in certain ways. In fact, there's a huge trend and a huge study in persuasive technologies, as they're called, in how machines can subtly, through the knowledge that their designers have of behavioral psychology, persuade us to use certain commercial products or persuade us to be healthier or to be more consumerist. So I think that these are important things to consider. And of course, this will get all the more complicated when we ourselves begin to integrate some of these technologies into ourselves. So these are psychological aspects of ourselves that we just need to be aware of because it's going to be destabilizing for us. And what it does to us in terms of really either enhancing what is best in our nature, really bringing out which may be worse in our nature, is something that we have to guard against or promote as it comes to life.
Absolutely. That makes sense.
All right. Phil, do we have time for our last question?
I think so. Why don't we? Well, let's try to end on a higher note, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the that shocking story about the Korean couple and other people that get addicted to computer games and everything, it almost comes across like a premature effort to transcend sometimes. But your book ends with a quote from I think it's by Clive Howell. Transcendence is the only real alternative to extinction. I guess, you know, getting from here and now, where we still live primarily in the physical world, to transcendence, I guess that's what the hybrid age is all about. Is that how we get there, just we navigate the hybrid age?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's the idea, you know, that the idea is not to really think that technology can be controlled or can be stopped, but that we can really use it to kind of transcend our current limitations, whether they are physical or emotional or geographical. And in a way, the only option that we have, given that there are so many different nodes and so many different people working in different parts of these technologies. And remember, one of the fundamental assumptions that we start with is that these technologies are accelerating, but not in silos. As they're accelerating on their own trajectories, they're also merging, which gives them further speed. And you can't control any one of these different trajectories. So the key really is to have a good technique to absorb them, to accept them, to learn to coexist with technology in a harmonious manner, and in doing so to transcend the kind of life that we lived before as a species, and also the kind of society that we accepted, that we lived in. So we don't only live with humans, but we actually are entering an era of human technology civilization. And it can offer us tremendous potential to become more enlightened, more productive, and happier in the future than we've ever been before.
Great
Absolutely.
Stuff.
The name of the book is Hybrid Reality, Thriving in the Emerging Technology Civilization. It's available now for Kindle. Is it any other places that it can be picked up?
It's also on Nook and on iTunes.
Excellent. Okay.
So download it to your whatever your favorite e-reader is, folks. It's out there for you. Follow the links at speculus.com. Aisha, best of luck to you with the book. Congratulations on that, and thank you so much for being with us. We hope that we'll be able to bring you back on the program at some point down the road and talk a little further about these ideas.
Thank you so much. This was really fun. Thank you very much. Bye, everyone.
Thank you. All right, Stephen, what's our music this evening?
Our music tonight is Bizarro World. Actually, it's a couple of Superman villains in the song. It's kind of fun. It's by The Thump, Bizarro World.
The Thump singing Bizarro World. All right. Well, we'll listen for references to, I guess, Bizarro number one and some other secret Superman villain. So thanks for putting that together, Stephen, and thanks for your contributions this evening. Thanks to our friends in the chat room. We didn't interact with you much this evening, but appreciate you, as always, everyone listening to the program live and everyone listening to us via MP3. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back with an all-new program at the usual time next week. And until then, live to see it.
Hey, hey, you know what would suck if Mr. Nick Gibson's nickname was Bob?
I'm Bob! Oh, son of a...
Me Bizarro Adam
and me Bizarro Ram.
You're sorry. understood. One would think that we should need to care about you, and he understands. Hey, what's the deal? Me just say how me feel. Well, that am a nice thing for you to say, Bizarro Ran. Here in Bizarro World, folks go out of their way to smile and say, have a terrible day in Bizarro World.
There, me have said it. Me hope you are unhappy. Now me feel even better.
I do feel unhappy.
Well, good.
Bizarro good or regular good?
Regular good, I guess, but sarcastic.
Ha ha.
What am funny?
We just got Nix's picnic joke from previous pod.
Here in Bizarro World, folks go out of their way to smile and say, have a terrible day in Bizarro World. Happy means sad, and good means bad, sorry means glad, and whack means rad in Bizarro World. In Bizarro World.
Le Roi shouts a rod every coup d'etat.
It's that turn that highest stage, je ne sais quoi, of Bizarro World.
The five stages, the grief, the constant joie de vivre.
And we start our AA meetings with an aperitif.
Après des bourgeoisie, or go to MIT.
Au contraire means we.
And on we means we. Me ambivalent.
Me just want to live.
Whatever.
Bad day, Bizarro Rand. Hello.
Hello forever.
It's Bizarro and Bizarro World. It's Bizarro and Bizarro World. It's Bizarro and Bizarro World. Bizarro World, at the end of the day, we just wanna do.